from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, this election season's background debate over the proper place of the church and religion in America's formal civic life often ends in a confusing tangle of claims over what the founding fathers envisioned. It's time to consult the source material, says our guest tonight, this hour on Point, Reverend Forrest Church, on the founding fathers and the separation of church and state in America. But first, we begin tonight in Florida, where tourists and residents in the Florida Keys are scrambling to avoid the wrath of Hurricane Ivan, even as millions of Floridians are still picking up the pieces after Hurricanes Francis and Charley. Ivan could hit the Keys as early as Sunday, potentially adding to the billions of dollars in damage already done by the two previous storms. Some are asking if Florida still adds up under repeated hurricanes as an economic proposition. Jerry Jackson is senior business reporter at the Orlando Sentinel. I asked him how hard a hit Ivan is likely to deliver.
The forecast does not look too good. Right now it looks like the same area that got hit by Charley could be seeing Ivan. That would be in the south of the Tampa Bay area.
Jerry, it's been quite a series of blows. The insurance companies are going to have a lot to pay out here. What's their response been to all of this damage?
Well, they have flooded the state with adjusters, and they have really gone full bore here to try to get their arms around it. But this is an unprecedented event for the industry. It's even greater magnitude in some ways than Andrew in 1992, which created something like 850 million individual claims. And so far, the early estimates are that it looks like maybe 1.5 million for these two storms combined. So it's taxing companies, no doubt about it. The question is how smaller, less well-capitalized insurers are going to come out on the backside of this. And fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately for ratepayers, the state does have a catastrophe fund that's been funded by Florida homeowners for some time now, and that's going to be tapped, and it's up in the air now as to whether or not that's going to do the trick. The state is looking at it closely, and so it's a really tremendous issue.
We see that some insurance companies have stopped writing new homeowner and auto policies for Florida right now. How long is that likely to last, and are Floridians simply going to have trouble getting insurance at some point?
Well, that is the ultimate question that's going to face the state. Our growth depends on the ability of homeowners to get insurance, obviously. So the state is going to be doing everything in its power, you can be assured of that, to make sure that insurers do stay in the state and do write policies. Exactly what it's going to take to achieve that, no one really knows right now.
Is there a point at which people think, well, hurricanes seem to be blowing through here too often, the price is too great, and Florida's just kind of a losing proposition because of the climate?
That's an issue that we're now facing for the first time. Historically, we really have been fortunate on hurricanes. The last big one that came right through the heart of Central Florida was Donna in 1960. Experts have been saying for some time that we're overdue for some big ones and that we face a number of years, most likely, of stronger storms because of various cycles. And this year is proving true. So the psychology on homeowners, on people moving into the state and out of the state is going to be a tricky issue in the next 3 to 6 months. And the thinking now is that if Ivan does come in here, that's probably going to be the tripwire. We will actually start to see movement sooner rather than later. And, you know, we've done a fair amount of surveying here on our own, unofficially with people, readers and whatnot.
Yeah.
And we're getting a lot of resistance from folks about moving. The thinking is that the odds are that it's not going to happen again. And it's the price that people pay for living on the coast and in the state. We're a peninsula, obviously, and vulnerable from every direction.
But looking down the road, what are your futurists saying now in Florida, your economic prognosticators, big thinkers? Has the state possibly simply become too built up and so densely populated that when these hurricanes hit, their price tag is just too high somehow?
We have a lot of things going for the state that we did not have 50 years ago. when big storms coming through the state sent people packing, and the economy did suffer for long periods of time. But economists tell us that the recent history is that cities, communities do rebuild, and we proved it after Andrew in 1992 when a good part of South Florida was literally flattened. And the state of Florida's economy did bounce back after that. The gross state product actually ticked up because of the amount of construction that went on after that for several years. And we're going to have several years of reconstruction underway here. But there are a lot of businesses that have lost revenue that they'll never recoup. And the tourist industry is the number one industry in Florida, as you know, and that industry thrives on our reputation as a vacation paradise, and that reputation is now tarnished.
Jerry Jackson, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, sir.
Jerry Jackson is senior business reporter at the Orlando Sentinel. He spoke with me from Orlando. Back in 1800, Thomas Jefferson, who often spoke about nature's God, was criticized for not being religious enough to be president. Today, in 2004, President Bush's born-again belief and strong evangelical backing have some Americans wondering if religion is sitting too tall in the Oval Office. Meanwhile, Bush's challenger, John Kerry, a Catholic, has found himself very publicly at odds with his church over abortion. Since its earliest days, America has been passionately debating the proper relationship between church and state and honing its argument for the separation of church and state, says Forrest Church, senior minister for the past 26 years at All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. That debate still plays out in the furor over abortion, gay marriage, stem cell research, and more. But make no mistake about it, Church argues in a new book reviewing the Founding Fathers' writings on the subject, from George Washington to John Adams and on down the line, the founders finally agreed that separation of church and state was the way. Their thinking needs review today, he says. Forrest Church has strong credentials to take us back to the source material. He has a Ph.D. in church history from Harvard. He is the son of the late Senator Frank Church of Idaho. He has lived and worked in the thick of the American debate. Tonight on Point, Forrest Church on the Founding Fathers and the American separation of church and state. Do you worry that the wall between church and state is eroding in America today? Or are you glad for more God in government? What do you think the founders would make of the church-state relationship in America in 2004? What would Jefferson say? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Forrest Church, senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church. His new book is The Separation of Church and State, Writings on a Fundamental Freedom by America's Founders. Good evening and welcome, Forrest Church.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. We all have our antenna out on this subject today, no matter where you come at it from. As you look out on the landscape of American church and state relations, against the backdrop of swings this way and that in American history, what do you see going on today, Forrest Church?
Well, there's always there's been an involvement of religion in politics from the very beginning. You mentioned that that 1800 race between Adams and Jefferson, which was a very lively race. Godless Tom Jefferson. The irony is that if one of those two men was actually the truer skeptic, it was probably Adams, and both of them were Unitarian. But Adams was more favorable to church establishments, and Jefferson was allergic to them. So the New England clergy, the Congregationalists particularly, branded Jefferson an infidel and atheist, drawing from his notes on Virginia. And the interesting factor is, and this happens again and again throughout our history, those who bailed Jefferson out were the evangelicals. They were the Presbyterians and the Baptists who cared less that their president himself was faithful to the views that they held than they did that they would have absolute religious freedom to exercise their own consciences. So in some ways, the creation of a church-state separation was a joint enterprise between the Enlightenment figures, such as Jefferson and Madison, and the evangelical Baptists and Presbyterians.
We're going to come back and look at exactly that. And it's interesting, as you say, Adams went at Thomas Jefferson. On the other hand, as you note, in the Treaty of Tripoli, it was President John Adams who signed on to this, quote, John Adams, as the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, and off it went. But take us back to the present for a second, Forest Church. Do you see the religious right, the evangelical movement, which is very strong in the United States today? I mean, when you were first getting into the ministry was the time when Is God Dead was the Time magazine cover, and today, clearly, the religious revival is enormous in the United States. Do you see the evangelical movement still sort of standing guard at this wall of separation between church and state, or pushing for something different?
It's changed entirely. It's changed, actually, since 1960, when it was the evangelicals who were most adamant not only about a separation of church and state, but also about a separation of religion and politics, when they were concerned about Kennedy's Catholicism. Mm. There has been a complete reversal of roles. And one of the reasons to go back to the history a bit is to point out that certain assumptions, namely that this was a Christian nation and it no longer is and we must return to that, we do have a religious nation, but we've had a resolutely secular government from the outset, and that was the intention of the founders. So there is some confusion on the part of some of the more radical exponents of the religious right. They also forget that the separation of church and state is primarily to separate or to protect the church from the state, more even than it is to protect the state from the church.
So if there's, in your word, a bit of forgetfulness going on here, do you see that behind this plethora of controversies we have over the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, over the faith-based initiatives and whether that's the right thing or not, over the Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance and school prayer and right on down, stem cell research, abortion, homosexual or gay marriage. Is there a confusion about church-state relations that's somehow playing into these hot issues today?
Well, this values division, apparent division in the nation, endangers the possibility of the creation of a religious party and a secular party. We're not there yet, anywhere close to being there. But then we'll be in real trouble because the fundamentalists of the left, the purblind secularists who believe that there's no place whatsoever for the expression of any kind of religious view in our politics, will either be successful and the church and free expression of religion will be diminished, or on the other hand, the fundamentalists of the right, who are now in power and appear to be very successful, will overlook the vital distinction between church and state, and we will end up having a faith-based presidency. We're in danger. We're not there yet, but we're in danger of that.
So time to look back. We're going to get into all of that. But you do point out for us, Church, that right from the get-go, this was not an easy debate. The country spent some 30 years sorting it out in its
youth. That's exactly right, Tom.
All the way from right through 1802 and Thomas Jefferson's declaration that the Bill of Rights constituted a wall of separation.
Yes.
There it is. We are talking tonight about the American separation of church and state in the beginning. And now my guest is Forest Church. He is in his 26th year as senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. He's written or edited about 20 books, holds a Ph.D. in church history from Harvard. His new book is entitled The Separation of Church and State: Writings on a Fundamental Freedom by America's Founders. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you worried that the wall between church and state is eroding in America today? Or are you glad for more God in government? What do you think the founders would make of the church-state relationship in the United States in 2004? What would Thomas Jefferson say? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American separation of church and state in the beginning and now. My guest is Forrest Church, minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in Manhattan. His new book is The Separation of Church and State, and he looks at the early writings of the founders in the long debate and resolution of this issue way back when. You can join the conversation tonight. President John Adams said the government of the USA, quote, is not in any way founded on the Christian religion. Do you agree? Are you prepared to argue with a founder? And where is the rise of the religious right pushing the church-state line? Out of bounds or back where it should be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Forrest Church, give us the short course, if you would, on we know where it ended up with the wall of separation. But this grew out of a time in the United States where there were, as you alluded earlier, established religions in many states. That is, government tax supported in Maryland, Delaware, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Congregationalists in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Connecticut. It wasn't the way this country began. How did we get there?
Well, first, the wall of separation is Jefferson's term. That is not in the Constitution itself. The First Amendment simply reads, where we end up is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We got to that point through the gradual exercise of ever greater liberty throughout the century and three quarters that led to the revolution itself. President Taft once said that the Puritans came to our country to establish the freedom of their own religion, not the freedom of anyone else's. Even though religious liberty was very strongly in their own minds, they were actually quite repressive of the Quakers and of the Baptists. It was Roger Williams, a Baptist preacher, who believed in soul liberty and created the first truly free, religiously free state in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Then William Penn came in, a Quaker, and created in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania a state where all the different religious persuasions were given latitude and liberty. These were very successful experiments. By the time of the Revolution itself, even the evangelical movement had sponsored, as it often does, through the wildfire of the preaching and the individual conversions, a impetus toward liberty that created a joint movement among the Enlightenment founders and the dissenting preachers toward a complete separation of church and state, in part to take those religious establishments, which were by this point somewhat benign.
And again, when you say establishments, you mean those supported by the state at the time.
That's right. What was going on, for instance, in Massachusetts was that the Congregationalists were given financial support and clergy paid by mm-hmm. state assessment. In Virginia, the same was true for the Episcopalians. Then there was a transition toward the notion that, well, we'll have established religion. We will tax all the citizens to support religion, but we'll give that money to all of the different faiths. Mm. This was the Patrick Henry compromise in Virginia. Interestingly enough, even though at this point the Baptists would receive their fair share, the money that they paid in would come back to them, so it wouldn't be a internal taxation without representation
right.
issue, which is what made the Patriots so angry that what we were doing to ourselves was the same thing we were accusing the British of doing to us. That compromise was not deemed acceptable because the strong evangelicals and the Enlightenment deists believed that any state involvement in and support of religion was bad for religion and to one extent or another could not help but curb freedom of conscience.
And here we get this amazing convergence, confluence of interest between two quite different groups. You just named them, the sort of Enlightenment deists and the children of the Great Awakening, the strong evangelicals. Their views on religion were by no
diametrically
means
opposed.
Describe those
yes,
two
but
and how they came
they
together.
They could not. Well, the The Enlightenment deists believed in a very dispassionate creator, unengaged. George Washington never mentions the word Jesus Christ, the words Jesus Christ, in all the multiple volumes of his entire correspondence and papers. He speaks of the great designer, the architect, the grand architect.
And you describe Washington as maybe the most secular-minded of the founders, along with Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, probably so. There's no question that he had a deep respect for religion, but himself had absolutely not even a hint of personal piety, and no interest in religious disputation. He found it to be corrosive to the national commonweal.
And yet, and we'll come back to this. And yet, he, as you note, he closed his presidency with this call, this elevation of the celebration of the central importance of morality and religion for the future survival of the state. That is often quoted these days.
That is the balance point here. All of these people, and remember that Jefferson said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights." For him, the metaphysic behind the Declaration of Independence was a spiritual and divine metaphysic. That's what made equality and liberty mandates. So there is a religious impetus informing the founders, both the evangelical ones and the Enlightenment ones. But all of these people together coalesced, and a great majority finally coalesced around the very prudent decision that our government should itself be resolutely secular.
Let me ask
in order permit it the greatest amount of religious freedom and rights of conscience.
Let me ask you about how that happened and the dynamic within that, because here you have these very different views. They come together behind that view, but did they reach this agreement with the sense of a kind of competition behind the agreement? I mean, in his campaign for the presidency, as you point out, Thomas Jefferson was reviled by some evangelicals as godless. Did they say, all right, it's prudent for us to keep church out of religion and out of government and government out of the church business, but we still have a competition going on here. We evangelicals don't agree with you deists, and we're going to one day sway this country in our direction. Was that still afoot?
Well, again, it was not the evangelicals so much as the established churches who were concerned about Jefferson. Any minority group has every reason to be extremely concerned when the government gets in the religion business, or when we end up electing not a commander-in-chief but a theologian-in-chief. That goes all the way back. But, Tom, if you go through our history from that election on down, it's interesting. The three candidates, presidential candidates, who were most biblical in their orations, in their pronouncements, were William Jennings Bryan, who was a fire-breathing liberal populist who ran three times Democrat around the turn of the last century. Mm-hmm. And the second of those would have been Theodore Roosevelt in 1912, when he announced his Progressive Party campaign by saying, we stand at Armageddon and battle for the Lord. And then the third was George McGovern in 1972. If you go back to George McGovern's speeches, you will find them filled with the rhetoric of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the New Testament, the Old Testament prophets. So you have a combination throughout our history until very recently of evangelical and progressive politics that I think we've lost some track of by virtue of the complete negative print image we have of religion in politics today.
I want to dive in to exactly what you're pulling up from the founders on the religious front to get some taste of that, but I can't resist going first to a caller calling from Eden, North Carolina, that is. Brett, you're on the air. Well, thanks for joining us.
Oh, how nice that my call was taken.
Well, it had to be, didn't it?
Well, one of the things that I was hoping might come out today, and since you took my call, I guess it is that Thomas Jefferson, although, lambasted for being godless, he put together a document that he called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, and it was later sort of subtitled the Jefferson Bible and distributed to new Congress people when they, were freshmen. And in this text, what Jefferson did was he took the four Gospels of the New Testament,
right,
and extracted from them the actual voice of Jesus Christ and removed all of the context and politics and so forth and other things that could, you know, the connective tissue of the story, as it were.
Right. And we know that story. But, Brett, let me ask you, what does that say to you about Thomas Jefferson and his view of religion?
Well, it tells me that in a lot of ways, he kind of seemed to be in agreement with your Ten Commandments, pretty much, but he didn't really say that it had to be a Christian belief. It just made good sense. And, you know, my thing is that if someone gets elected because there is something, spiritually resonant about that person, I think we're always at a loss for a measure of whether or not that person is actually walking their talk. Mm-hmm. And I find that this document that Thomas Jefferson put together is a wonderful barometer, as it were, of conduct.
Looking to Jesus, in this case, as a kind of philosopher. Brett, thanks very much for calling in from Eden.
I'm delighted that Brett mentions the Jefferson Bible, because some years ago I did the new edition of that Jefferson
That's
Bible,
right,
which is also available at Beacon. And it's a fascinating document. It begins with Jesus' birth and ends with the rolling of a stone, but throughout it has all of his primary teachings. Jefferson himself said that it's in our lives and not in our words that our religion must be read. His own life gets judged accordingly. But that is a good benchmark, I think, for all of us who take a look at politicians and their pious protestations. We should be very careful to make sure that their life is speaking as eloquently, ideally more eloquently, than their words.
But Forest Church, it raises the issue that we hear lately, that whatever the words of the Constitution, whatever Thomas Jefferson's phrase, the wall of separation, you hear the argument that the founders simply presumed that this would be a nation that would be informed at the least, the state would be informed at the least by the Christian ethos that was so dominant at that time, and that modern secularists have, the argument goes, have taken that way beyond where the founders might have imagined. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, we're probably a more religious nation in some ways now than we were then. Only 10% of the population belonged to churches. There was a higher level of commitment involved before you could join. The first six founders, or at least the first five, were strong secularists. The first six, three of the six Unitarians. There is no question but that people back then did raise the issue as to whether or not God should be placed in the Constitution, and that was always voted down. There is no mention of religion, save the one clause in the sixth article of the Constitution, which suggests that there can be no religious test for holding political office, another issue that was quite lively in the debate. The argument was, if you were not a Christian, how could you be a good leader? And the decision was clear that was irrelevant. Your faith, your protestations, whatever they be of faith, were secondary to your character. So that assumption that we were once a Christian nation, everyone took that for granted, and now we've lost that, is a mistaken assumption.
So when John Adams wrote that the United States government is, in his words again, is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, would that have been the subject of debate among his peers?
Yes, it was. It was. Now, those were not his own words. Those are the words of the Treaty of Tripoli.
Yes, which was, remind
us, 1787. Mm-hmm. It was indeed published by him and ratified unanimously by the United States Senate. So there was no argument there. There was argument in the press. A number of people wrote there were letters to the editor back then. As a matter of fact, the press was, if anything, even more lively back at the to the turn of the 19th century than it is today in the vividness of the rhetoric. But there were a number of people who felt that this was absolutely un-American to announce that the United States of America was not in any way founded on the Christian religion. It didn't certainly raise a murmur at that point in the United States Senate, which unanimously ratified the Treaty of Tripoli. It's not an important treaty. It's just it's an interesting little
but
window.
It's stunning language.
It's an interesting today. Window on that yeah. world that has gotten quite dirty and needs to be cleaned off, I think.
We're talking with Forrest Church, senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. Robin is calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to point out that we have such religious diversity in this country, and I even think that Thomas Jefferson was making a nod to that when he did write, and I know that you had quoted this previously about the all men are created equal, but he says, and they are endowed by their creator, not the creator, and sort of acknowledging that everyone comes from these different backgrounds, and everyone, all the different states had their religious, the deists, the Unitarians, and that looking back on history, that they escaped the countries that were persecuting them for different religious beliefs and fled to America. And I think he was looking back to that and didn't want America to sort of follow in those footsteps.
So what does that leave you thinking about the status of the separation of church and state today, Robin?
Well, I think we're in a dire state. We've spent a great deal of time protecting the church from the state. But now the roles are reversed a little bit, and now we need to protect the state from the church. I was raised Christian, and I certainly have that faith, but I certainly acknowledge that not everyone in this country is Christian and shares the same belief. And I applaud those people running for office who understand that they have to represent all of the people, not just the Christians.
Robin, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call, Forrest Church.
Robin is so right. One of the reasons that we're such a profoundly religious country is precisely because we have a line of demarcation between church and state. Whenever the church and the state get in bed together, it's the church that finally ends up sacrificing her honor. And having to wonder or should ask the question, will he respect me in the morning? The answer is no. You go to this goes all the way back to the beginning of the Christian Imperium. But in the European countries where clergy are supported by assessment, places like Sweden, where the Lutheran Church is supported by the government, and you have a church-state collusion, no one goes to church. What happens eventually is the church loses its individual or its independent moral authority. And for that very reason, the early Baptists and Presbyterians were as avid in their support of church and state separation as were the deists and Unitarians.
Forrest Church, stand by. We are talking about the American separation of church and state in the beginning. And now my guest is Forrest Church, author of The Separation of Church and State, Writings on a Fundamental Freedom by America's Founders. You can join the conversation. Is the United States flirting with theocracy? Or are we still within the margins of history's precedent? Are secularists too worried? Are evangelists too aggressive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American separation of church and state in the beginning. And now my guest is Forrest Church, author of the new book, The Separation of Church and State. You can join the conversation. President John Adams said it. The government of the United States, he said, is, quote, in the Treaty of Tripoli, is not in any way founded on the Christian religion. Do you agree? Are you prepared to argue with a founder? And where is the rise of the religious right pushing the church-state line out of bounds or back to where it ought to be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Monica is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Monica. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
A comment and a question at the same time. My question was about the current role of atheism in today's politics. It seems that, you know, we all accept that there are other religions other than Christianity that we need to protect, but what about the atheists, the agnostics? Will we ever be able to accept a candidate, a presidential candidate who's an atheist, who is godless?
Monica, thanks for the call. Not necessarily a bad question for a Unitarian minister for his church. What do you say?
Well, there have been candidates who have been considered atheist and who got elected. Thomas Jefferson, we've noted, is certainly one. I don't think the atheists are in quite a minority in this country. We probably aren't quite prepared for an atheist president, at least an evangelical atheist. There may well have been a number of presidents who were atheists but were somewhat demure on the topic. The present president is one of only three that I can identify truly, strongly, and clearly born again and deeply pious in his belief, the other two being Woodrow Wilson and Jimmy Carter, both of whom had a deeper respect for the line of demarcation between church and state. This is the first time we've had prayers opening cabinet meetings. We have a faith-based office, not only in the executive offices, but also in the Veteran Affairs offices and the Small Business Administration. There seems to be a breakdown in the consciousness of the importance of maintaining a certain degree of separation, and I do worry about that.
Forest Church, let me ask you, you pointed out earlier what's clearly true, that this debate culminated in the founding documents with the Establishment Clause in the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson went further. He wrote about the wall of separation that everyone now cites, the separation of church and state. How was that further step received at the time? How was it seen? Was it embraced?
Well, this will be
the American bedrock presumption?
It really wasn't received at the time because it was in a private letter. It was elevated into the larger consciousness in 1947 by Hugo Black in a Supreme Court decision.
Much later.
Much later. It's probably not today a helpful benchmark. It's hard to find a better metaphor. Wall is a little bit porous. I think more of a hedge, and a hedge can get overgrown and need to be trimmed. There certainly was no intention whatsoever that candidates for office could not express their own religious views, or that senators or congressmen could not vote according to their religious conscience. A person ought to vote according to his or her conscience, as far as I'm concerned. So we can get a little bit silly in terms of demanding too antiseptic a division between church and state. Both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause really were intended to protect the church from state interference and give people the greatest latitude for religious freedom of expression. There will be a backlash, however, if this trend continues and the government becomes more and more cozy with religious establishments. I can't help but think that the courts are going to reverse a number of the executive decisions made, for instance, on faith-based initiatives.
But the courts themselves, the court in particular, could change fairly dramatically in the direction of George Bush's view of the world in another Bush term. Are you so confident that the courts would turn these around?
Now, I'm not confident. The courts have been confused, as many Americans have, on the issue of church-state separation. They've actually been pretty good if you take a look at it over the long haul. There were no church-state separation decisions before the late 1940s. I mean, it never really came up. I guess the only way in which it came up earlier were in things such as the Mormons and polygamy or something like that. But there had been a kind of consensus that had built over the years as to what was acceptable and what was not. We're now testing that consensus rather vigorously, I would say. I am confident, however, that we will, given our enormous variety of beliefs and views, that a majority of Americans, and I think even today a majority of Americans, are uncomfortable with the notion that the President of the United States should see himself as invested in a religious or spiritual role as opposed to a purely political one.
Mark is calling from Boston. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom. You educate me every night, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, you're so welcome, Mark. What's on your mind?
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, a couple of years ago, I finally got around to reading the Constitution of my state, which is written by John Adams, and I was really surprised at how many references to God was in there, and it occurred to me, maybe he changed his tune by the time he got to be president, but that maybe he didn't, or maybe he believed in a separation of the politics of the Church of England, but he certainly felt that this was a nation that was founded under God by believers, and maybe a DPS could comment on that. But the question I have, which is more relevant to today's society, is I've been wondering why the gay rights issue has been fought as a on civil rights ground and not as a separation issue, because it seems to me that marriage itself is fundamentally a Judeo-Christian religious tradition that is established, you know, on religious grounds. And if your guest could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
We'll pick them both up, Mark, and maybe the gay marriage piece first. I mean, of course, many religions sanction and encourage marriage, so it wouldn't only be Judeo-Christian. But how? And we know you're not a jurist, Forest Church. But
what's interesting there, we can go back to Massachusetts on both of them. When the pilgrims came to Massachusetts, the marriage was not considered a religious sacrament, and by the pilgrims considered a religious sacrament. That develops later. The mistake in some ways we have made in terms of this church-state separation issue is giving the state determination that clergy can be appointed as sub officio officers of the state to perform the sacrament of marriage.
And so they're intertwined.
They got intertwined. In France, for instance, there's a very clear demarcation between a religious sacrament or ceremony, and I think religions have every right to determine who it is they can, whose unions mm-hmm. they can bless. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's the state's business. But at the same time, there's a secular ceremony, what you might call the marriage contract. That should be looked at not through the lenses of any given religious viewpoint, but rather with equal opportunity and justice under law as the primary consideration. My guess is that eventually that will become a national, through the courts probably more than through the Congress, will become a recognition, a national recognition. That, however, should not in any way impinge upon religious bodies' rights to sacramentally join any group that they wish or not.
And to Mark's second point about John Adams, he's looking at the Massachusetts Constitution there, saying this looks like a man who believed in a nation, in a commonwealth anyway, founded under God.
Yes. Well, if you take a look at in the separation of church and state, I have contrasting documents. Adams' Declaration of Rights and Constitution for Massachusetts, and the Virginia one, which reflects much more openly the way that the nation came. But Adams was basically an establishmentarian. He believed in religion more than he believed in God. He believed in the utility of religion to help maintain the public order. In that respect, he was quite a great deal like Washington. But when Adams and Jefferson started writing to one another in their later years, neither of them had a dotage, thank goodness, because those letters are magnificent. But as they started writing to one another, if you really look at it, it's Adams who's the greater skeptic. He really, when he's pushed beyond the social niceties of the matter, he is far less reverent and devout than Jefferson, who is willing to go a long way with Jesus, for instance, much further than Adams himself was.
Give us a choice phrase from Adams that expresses that skepticism.
Oh, I can't think of an exact one. He does say in a kind of saucy manner when there has been a delegate to the Congregational Convention who was the first clergyman to serve in that capacity. He wrote back to Abigail. She said, "Let us just pray that he will be the last." So, in fact, there was John Witherspoon, one one clergyman who did sign the Declaration of Independence, who was the president of Princeton and a great contributor, frankly, to the church-state separation.
And there a word from the Founding Father. Forrest Church, we're out of time. We thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's been a great pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Forrest Church, his new book is The Separation of Church and State. In a moment, Vice Presidential candidate John Edwards hits President Bush's record hard on the stump in New Hampshire. This is On Point. A new Washington Post ABC News poll shows that President Bush has now forged a clear lead over Democratic challenger John Kerry and has strengthened his position on nearly every issue important to the campaign. For the first time in a Post survey, the poll shows Bush with the support of the majority of likely voters, 52%, 9 points ahead of his rival. The Kerry campaign has responded to its new underdog role fiercely over the last couple of days. Today, Vice Presidential candidate John Edwards was in the swing state of New Hampshire attacking President Bush's record. Throughout the rest of the campaign, On Point will be bringing you sounds from the stump. In our next installment, we will check in on Vice President Dick Cheney. Tonight, we bring you an excerpt of John Edwards in Nashua, New Hampshire, just after he paid tribute to the more than 1,000 soldiers who have died in Iraq.
Even with their heroic service, Iraq is a mess by any measure, and it's a mess because of this president and this vice president. And not only that, during his presidency, on their watch, Iran has moved forward with their nuclear weapons development program. North Korea has moved forward with their nuclear weapons development program. You know, this choice gets to be very simple at the end of the day. If you think millions of Americans losing their health care, millions losing their jobs, millions falling into poverty, health insurance premiums through the roof, typical families' income going down, the mess we now have in Iraq, if you think America's on the right track, you ought to vote for George Bush. If you don't, you ought to vote for President John Kerry. And you know, because of this record, you know, and this president's asking to be rehired. That's what he's asking. On this record, he's asking to be rehired. Because they can't defend the record, we know what we've all seen. All these negative personal attacks against John Kerry particularly. And the reason is because they can't defend what they've done. And I have come to the conclusion that they'll say just about anything, right? I mean, they'll say and do anything to try to keep their jobs. Just a few examples. Vice President Cheney, Dick Cheney, said... Dick Cheney said at the Republican convention, with a straight face, that they have made health care more affordable and more accessible for the American people. I don't know what America and what American people he's talking about, but it hasn't happened here in New Hampshire where health insurance premiums are up over $4,000. Hasn't happened in America where health insurance premiums are up over $3,500. More people covered, 5 million people have lost their coverage.
Democratic Vice Presidential candidate John Edwards speaking today in Nashua, New Hampshire. On Point will continue to bring you reports regularly from the campaign trail in the weeks ahead. Our next installment will feature the Republican's choice for VP, Dick Cheney. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.